Now, from the tiny nation of Vanuatu, population 250,000, to the giant US state of California, population approaching 40 million. The most populous state in the union, it's a technology powerhouse, but it's also a cultural and political trendsetter. Many commentators have observed that once same-sex marriage was first legalized in California back in 2008, it became inevitable that the rest of the country would ultimately follow suit. It wasn't the first state to accept gay marriage, but when California adopted change, it was a crucial national tipping point. Well, it's quite likely that California has again irreversibly tipped the national balance on another contentious political issue, this time euthanasia. On the 6th of October, Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill legalising physician-assisted suicide from 2016. Health law expert Professor Glenn Cohen, who's based at Harvard Law School, says we will probably look back on this signing as the day that changed the euthanasia debate forever.
This is extremely significant. California is roughly 12% of the U.S. population, so now more than 1 in 10 Americans has access to assisted suicide. And California is a mainstream state in the way many of the other states that have legalized the practice tend to be a little bit more, shall we say, fringe, a little more experimental. And so the fact that a mainstream state has done this is huge. I think it'll pave the way for more action in places like Massachusetts, New York, and the like.
How will this Californian scheme work?
Yeah, so there's a lot in the bill itself, but essentially it authorizes an adult who meets certain qualifications and who's been determined by his or her attending physician to have a terminal disease, which is defined by the statutes as roughly 6 months to live, to make a request for a drug prescribed pursuant to those statutory terms. And essentially it has requirements of assessing competence, multiple physicians, waiting periods, a series of kind of protections in place. And we talk about other kinds of protections in the bill. But I think what's important to understand is essentially it enables you to get a prescription that can help you to end your life. It's that kind of assisted suicide.
And who administers the prescribed drug? Is it the patient themselves or is it the doctor?
Typically what's contemplated is that the patient themselves will administer it or perhaps a loved one or the like. It's not particularly contemplated that it will be a physician that will do it.
What was the catalyst for this, what you're saying and what many people are saying is an absolute game changer in terms of the USA? What was the catalyst?
So there's a lot of things happening. So the most important thing to say is that public opinion has shifted, at least in California. There was one poll recently released by UC Berkeley that roughly 75% of Californians polled supported aid in dying medication for terminally ill individuals. Some people connect this to the case of Brittany Maynard, who was a young woman who left California for Oregon and became a resident of Oregon so that she could end her life using the Oregon statute. Governor Brown mentioned her and having spent time with her and talked to her family as part of his impetus to sign the bill. But in fact, closer to the time in which Brittany passed, there was an earlier attempt to get this through the legislature that didn't succeed. Brittany's case put a human face on this and also made it easier for more Americans to understand, and Californians in particular, why someone might need a law like this. And I think seeing this young woman having to move to Oregon in order to do this and disruption in her family and the like, I think was a very sympathetic case.
This issue of death with dignity is misunderstood by many people in our community and culture.
Brittany's video appeared on people.com first thing in the morning, October 6, 2014. By that afternoon, it broke all the records. By the time she died, a little over 3 weeks later, over 100 million people worldwide knew her and knew her cause.
But in general, I would say the third thing that's been perhaps related to this is having experienced more states doing this and not seeing the sky fall in any dramatic way, I think has also increased the comfort level of many individuals with these practices.
There were some very interesting arguments put on both sides. Jerry Brown, I spoke about his personal experience with serious illness and also the experiences of his family members.
He made the decision after a thorough consideration of the options. In a statement, the governor said, "In the end, I was left to reflect on what I would want in the face of my own death. I do not know what I would do if I were dying in prolonged and excruciating pain. I am certain, however..."
There was also an argument put by Californians against assisted suicide, which might not fly, say, in Western Europe or Australia or Canada, but the idea that many Americans don't have good health care and these people are at risk of being pushed into assisted suicide because the kind of health care that they'd be able to access would be pretty grim. It's a very interesting argument.
We followed the money that's driving this legislation. What we learned is shocking. First, the law will worsen patient care. For evidence, we only have to look to Oregon, where assisted suicide is legal. There we see cancer patients like Barbara Wagner, who are denied coverage by their insurance companies. What did her health plan agree to cover? Drugs for assisted suicide. That would cost about $50.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that it's an interesting argument. How much truth to it is, I'm a little skeptical for two reasons. First of all, if you're talking about an older population, we do have a socialized medical system for there that they call Medicare in the United States. The other reason is now with the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's act, more people are covered, or, you know, it's harder to remove coverage for people. And the third reason is that the bill itself tries to protect against pressure from family members. So, for example, it prohibits a contract, a will, or another agreement being conditioned upon you requesting aid in dying. It prohibits you from selling insurance or issuing insurance, health, life, annuity policies, or the like connected to this. It prohibits an insurance carrier from providing information to an individual about the availability of an aid in dying drug absent a request by that individual. And it does some other things. It makes some things a felony, for example, if people are trying to tamper or forge.
Now, coming back to the states that currently allow physician-assisted suicide, they are, as you mentioned before, rather smallish places. Can you tell me about them?
The states that permit it right now are Oregon, Washington, Vermont, and Montana. Oregon was the originator, and they've done it through different ways, through legislation, through referenda, in one case, through a Supreme Court decision, which could be overturned by the legislature. That's Montana. In some ways, this is, if you believe the framers of the U.S. Constitution, the genius of American federalism, is that we use states as laboratories for experimentation, and we see how things go. There is a lot of variation here, but those states have been in the vanguard. And I think most people would say Oregon is the place where we've had the longest experience. I think most people think it's been relatively a success. One of the interesting findings is there turned out to be many fewer requests for prescriptions than I think most of us thought. And of those who requested a prescription, about a third of them don't actually ever use it or even fill it out, I think, the prescription. So you see, for many people, it's comforting to have the prescription even if they don't use it.
The figures I've seen are that in the last 17 years in Oregon, there have been 1,173 prescriptions, and 421 of those haven't been used. So as you say, it's something that people might want as an option, but they're not necessarily going to use it.
That's exactly right.
These jurisdictions, Vermont, Washington, Oregon, Montana, all of them smallish, relatively homogenous. California, population 40 million, the absolute opposite. It's a huge place. It's very diverse, economically, religiously, ethnically. Given that profile of California, what should we look out for in terms of how this new law will play out?
You know, I think that part of this, what we're seeing, is the decline of the influence of religious leaders. You know, it's a little ironic in a year when the Pope visits California, and when California visits the United States, that we should also have this thing, which is quite opposed by Catholics. But I think that as more people have experiences with family members at the end of life, and again, we're living longer, so I think more of us are likely to have the experience of a loved one having a prolonged death, I think that's setting the stage for rethinking this issue. And the more confidence we have that this can be done in a way that's legally appropriate and not abusive, and it'll be interesting to see what California looks like 2 years from now or 3 years from now, data-wise, I think it really is kind of paving the way for rethinking elsewhere in the country.
It'll be fascinating to see both the take-up rates and the opposition by different ethnic religious groups. Obviously, there's a huge Hispanic population, there's a huge Caucasian population, there's a huge Asian population in California.
That's right. And each of them have distinct cultural traditions surrounding death and end of life and the like. So in some ways, you know, on the other hand, what's interesting about California is you say it's incredibly heterogeneous, a real salad bowl, if you will. But I do think that if I was a person who was advocating for this cause, I would see my victory in California as pretentious as the possible future steps in terms of consolidating these victories elsewhere. So I think it's a big deal for this movement and really now also increase their ability to raise funds and the like for further challenges.
You talk about the U.S. states being a laboratory and people can, if you like, look over the fence and see how it's done. What does the U.S. Supreme Court have to say? What does the federal government have to say? Do they have any overarching power in this area?
Several years ago, there was a U.S. Supreme Court challenge on assisted suicide, actually a pair of them, one called case called Glucksberg, the other called VACO. And here, essentially, these were individuals who were saying, I should have a U.S. federal constitutional right to commit suicide that should extend to aid in dying, and it was unconstitutional for my state to criminalize it. That challenge failed, essentially. That means that there's no federal constitutional right that would trump the decisions of all the individual states. On the other hand, they've never said, and they never will say, that there is unconstitutional to allow people to have assisted suicide. So they've really parked the question more or less in the states. And it'll be a process likely of convergence where more and more states will permit this and the like. Now, is it possible that the U.S. Supreme Court may revisit its decision in several years? You know, one kind of interesting comparison is gay marriage, where essentially, you know, we had, and even same-sex sodomy, where we had criminal statutes that were upheld, and then, you know, several years later, decades later, the Supreme Court says, well, things have changed, they're not upheld anymore, and we're going to say those kinds of statutes are unconstitutional. But I think we are a fair ways away from that. And really, I think you'd need many more states to make the change before anybody thinks it would be plausible to go back to the U.S. Supreme Court to try to get them to make it the law of the entire land.
The parallel with gay marriage is an interesting one because not only do you have the fights at the federal level on both euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide and gay marriage, but also change at the state level has come about by a number of different mechanisms, as you pointed out, legislation in places like California and Vermont, referendums or ballot measures in places like Washington, or case law, as in places like Montana. So there's not only a laboratory of different outcomes, there's also a laboratory of different routes to get to the point of legalization.
That's exactly right. And it's been quite interesting in different strategies, you know, and there have been also a number of failed attempts at referenda and legislation. So, you know, we're focused on the success stories, but there have also been significant failures. But I think this victory in California will really energize the people who believe in this kind of yes, we can sort of moment for the movement.
Professor Glenn Cohen from Harvard Law School. That's the Law Report for this week. Production by Anita Barrow and Nick Mirisch. Thanks to both. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more law.